welcome. We love it when there's more people, than more people come than we might expect. It's been the true all summer, so thank you for coming. My name is Sharon, and I serve the village's education lead in Chris VR. It's much easier just to say VR. At least I got his first name right, so perfect. Is going to continue his discussion of racism in America, and today it's deforming the beloved community, a history of racism after the Civil War. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you. Thank you all for being here. Some of you were here on Monday, and some of you were here Monday and are continuing the conversation. But just to review what we did, you'll see a timeline on the wall that we looked at a timeline of events since 400 BCE. And we're identifying points, not all points, but major points along the line of the creation of this thing called racism. And we also defined what racism is and separated out into three specific types. And we'll review that today. I'm not going to review the timeline today, but this was kind of the before. Today we're going to get into contemporizing this issue. We stopped at the American Civil War, or the war between the states, depending on what part of the country you come from. It's called different things. But that's where we stopped Monday, and then we're going to continue on today. But to set the stage, I want to begin with our scripture theme. Can someone read the Revelation passage that we're focusing on this summer?
He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more, nor crying, nor pain anymore. For the former things have passed away. And he who was seated on the throne said, "Behold, I am making all things new."
Let us pray. Gracious and loving God, we know that you are renewing and making all things new constantly and over and over. We give you thanks for your word in Revelation and your revelation in our lives. Today we're going to be talking about some challenging things, and we pray that you would guide our minds and hearts and spirits into your word. We pray in the name of the living God, who is the Christ. Amen. Okay. My name is Chris Voss Rothmeyer. I started on Monday, and I have been privileged to go to probably all of the sessions that have been led, and it's amazing to me how much cross-pollination there is. Gary's session, of course, is extremely relevant to what we're talking about. Kirsten's session is also bullying, and that very relevant to what we're talking about. And the Bible studies have been very important. So this is a very rich week to kind of get at some challenging issues. I want to begin with this brief call and response. Does anybody feel comfortable speaking in Spanish? I can do it if anybody doesn't, that's fine. There's part of this in Spanish and then the translation in English. The reason we're doing this is because through the trainings that I've been part of, this has kind of been central. It actually comes from a Mayan tradition. Call it a prayer, call it a meditation, call it a call and response, but it just centers the stage, centers our hearts. What are we doing? What does this work for? What I'll do is I'll read the Spanish, and you do your level best to say Spanish along with me. And then can I have someone read it, the English part? The English is the translation of the Spanish. Can I have someone read the English parts? Okay, thank you so much.
Is it possible to make that bigger, or are we stuck with that size?
Let's see.
Thank you.
Let's do it. This is a bigger risk here. But let's begin. Repeat after me. Tú eres mi orgullo.
Tú eres mi orgullo.
You are my other me.
You are my other me.
Si te hago daño a ti.
Si te hago daño a ti.
If I do harm to you.
If I do harm to you.
Me hago daño a mí mismo.
Me hago daño a mí mismo.
I do harm to myself.
I do harm to myself.
Si te amo y respeto.
Si te amo y respeto.
If I love and respect you.
If I love and respect you.
Me amo y respeto yo.
Me amo y respeto yo.
I love and respect myself.
I love and respect myself.
And then I came up, I presented some agreements as we were talking with a conversation that is challenging for many. Many of you have had this conversation before and feel like, well, this is a conversation I've had, but for many, this is a new conversation. But I want to honor both of those ends of the spectrum with some agreements that we can all adhere to. So these are mine whenever I have a conversation about racism. Stay engaged as much as possible. Try to stay awake after lunch, but also in your mind. Be present to what people are saying. Speak your truth responsibly, and I think the key word there is your. Speak your truth responsibly. Listen to understand. Be willing to do things differently and experience some discomfort. Expect and accept non-closure. This is an issue that has taken 500 years to create, at least, and we're not going to solve it this week, but it's an important step to take. And be confidential. Respect other people's opinions, no matter, you may disagree with them, and that's fine. But, up in the lunch hall or around the village, let's not say, well, so-and-so said this. Let their story be their story, and your story be yours. Okay. I don't gain any money from this, but I do feel, because I want to encourage risk-taking behavior, as I said on Monday, I want you to put yourself out there a little bit, and I'm actually engaging in a little raffle. This book will be given to one lucky person at the end of these three sessions. And I've got my hat here with the people who put their names in the hat on Monday. And the people who wrote on these stick notes, I've got a bunch over here, are those who felt like, I just took a bit of a risk. Or sometimes I noticed that someone took a risk and I put their name in there. And I appreciate that. I want to encourage risk-taking behavior. You may not feel comfortable all the time, and maybe if you say something that you've not ever said before, go ahead and put your name in there. I'll give you, possibly, a free book on Friday. How cool is that? This book, by the way, is written by James Loewen. If you've heard of... my goodness gracious. Sorry, Howard Zinn. This is a similar kind of a book to that. It's Howard Zinn... is a revisionist historian. He teaches things that are not necessarily in the history books that we read in high school. And this man is coming from a similar point of view. It's called Lies My Teacher Told Me, and when I raise this book to my middle schoolers, they say, oh yeah, Mr. V, so you're going to teach us some lies? Well, actually, I'm going to try to teach you a couple truths that you've not probably ever heard before. Lies My Teacher Told Me. And you also get, no extra charge, two Powell's Bookstore bookmarks. I'll put those right there to sweeten the pot. All right. So if you feel like you've made a risky move, come up here. I've got the stick notes, or I may give you one on my own. Here's a pen.
I have a question.
Please.
May we enter our names in there more than once?
Since absolutely.
I was the first one that... my name in, yes,
everybody. Put your name in there every time you put yourself out there, and I appreciate that. All right, by way of review, this is not my own model. This is a model that I got from a website called Dismantling Racism. It's full of all kinds of helpful resources about how to lead workshops, if you will, resources for how to engage in this conversation. When we defined racism a few days ago, I didn't show this image, as I mainly talked about the three types of racism. I didn't even define racism, which I'll do here in just a moment. But there are three types. There's the personal, there's the institutional, and there's the cultural. Personal racism might be something from an interactive conversation that you might be having with somebody. One in which, here's an example I gave on Monday. If an employer is looking at resumes and sees a name that sounds Hispanic or sounds not quite European and says, I'm not sure if I'm going to interview that person, that might be a personal racism issue. Or, you know, if you were in the session a few hours ago, Kirsten had presented a scenario in which there were people standing in line and people in front are speaking in Spanish at a movie theater, and then all of a sudden one person blurts out, well, speak English, because in this country we speak English. It's the standard language. That would be an example of personal racism. And then there is institutional racism, which touches on policies and practices. One example of that I brought up on Monday is standardized tests. And this might not seem so impactful, but here's the challenge. Imagine if you're coming to this country and you come with your own cultural beliefs and practices, and then you enter the school system, and in order to get eventually into a college, you need to take standardized tests or to move beyond education. But those questions are asked in a way that favors the cultural understanding of people who grew up here, who speak English, and who understand this culture. Well, this is a huge impact because these tests are used, of course, to judge whether a person is ready for college or not. But what if you come from a different culture and a different understanding? Then you're automatically disadvantaged. You're automatically disadvantaged when you take this test. So institutional racism, when there are policies and practices built into the institutions that we engage in every day. And then there's cultural racism, which gets into more beliefs and norms. One I brought up again. If you see a black person and they're taking care of a lot of children, or maybe of their two children, and you say, well, they're probably on welfare. I know that's a very, I'll just admit that's a racist thing to say or to think. But it goes back into the realm of beliefs. What do you believe about that person? Simply because of the way they act, or just because you bring to the situation certain beliefs about that person without ever interacting with him or her? You are making a judgment based on beliefs. Never mind that there's corporate welfare that also drains a lot more resources and income from this country than single people do, draining tens of millions and billions of dollars from the economy. And we call that fine, because of course it's good to get as much money as you can. It brings us closer to God, right? Being rich is a sign of God's blessing. But these are the examples. We'll get more into this issue. Yes, sir.
We were doing one of these kind of things at church, and the person presenting put a fourth one up that I had never heard of or thought of. And if I could say the word, it would be more impressive. But it's when it's the person who is the target of racism buying into it, being convinced by it. So in not embodying.
Internalized oppression.
Internalized, thank you.
Okay. Internalized oppression.
Yeah. Yeah. So that you start to believe the things that are said about you or. And never crossed my mind that would, and it makes perfect sense. Yeah. If that's all you hear all your life, you're going to start internalizing it and making it, fulfilling the expectation.
Thank you. Internalized racism is a key term to understand what is to internalize the beliefs that other people have about you. Now, that woman that I saw, is she going to start believing that she's not very capable, that she's not competent? Is she going to start believing that? If you start reading stories to your kids about white culture, are my children of color going to think, well, white people are the ones who make things happen, or the white people are the ones who are capable and competent? I don't seem to be in these stories. So I guess my belief is that I can't do anything. Now, that's internalized racism. That's an important concept to remember. Thank you. Okay. All right. I promised that I would fill in a gap when we were talking about the Declaration of Independence. Great document, by the way. It's a barn burner of a document. You got to read it sometime. And it was written by our forefathers. And one of the key terms there is fathers. And they were all white. Let me also say this. Let me pause here for just a second before I go on to this. Those of you who were here on Monday or who came in today, you can close your eyes or you don't have to. But as you walked through that door and you saw me standing up here, attend to your feelings and attend to your thoughts. What were you thinking? What were you expecting? How did you feel about me as a speaker without even ever hearing me open my mouth? Were you confident coming in here that you would learn something, that you would gain something? Did you give me some credibility that I didn't even earn yet.
Sure, I'll be the first one to say it. Plus you look, you know, you look like you've been here before. And you look like you're comfortable here.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I gave you the benefit of the doubt.
Right, right. Now imagine walking
sticky.
Into that. I'm sorry?
Sticky.
Sticky.
Oh, he.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Thank you. All right. Now imagine. I'll let you tease those out here. I'm capable of doing this. Imagine now walking into that door and I'm black. Or I'm Hispanic. And I'm female. Sense of anticipation, credibility that you have in the speaker.
I would have thought more of it, you know, because that person was coming from their own experience as being having a lot of racist directed at them.
I think that coming from a Minnesota, the most diversity when I was growing up is that we had one Catholic in our grade and everybody else was Protestant. So there was, you know, no racial diversity. And I live in a pretty white Norwegian town. So I think coming in, I would have a moment of feeling a little differently, and I would have to say it wouldn't be based on anything other than the person's appearance. I'm not necessarily saying I would think less of that person, but I'm just saying it would be different.
Okay, go ahead.
So we live in the most ethnically diverse city in the United States. And I would give it more credibility if there was a minority person standing up front.
Absolutely.
Long Beach, California.
Mm-hmm. But only because the topic is racism. And that is something they would have experienced. I don't know how much credibility I would give them if it were something unrelated.
Yeah. Imagine if any of the speakers this week were of a different color, different so-called race than they are. And your point's well taken. Maybe you would ascribe more credibility to someone who's who has lived experience in a certain sense. Now, I would argue that we all have lived experience with racism, whether we recognize it or not. We all feel pain over this issue. But what I'm just trying to do is say that typically, many people would walk into a classroom or a room like this and ascribe more credibility to a person, to a white person, and even a white male, than a person of color. And so I want to acknowledge that white privilege is going on even now. It's operating even now as we walk into this room. And we'll talk more about white privilege in a short while. Okay. So, you know who wrote the Declaration of Independence? Thank you. Thomas Jefferson. Thank you for remembering that from your sophomore year. It gives me hope that my students are going to remember something of what I teach them. I made the point a couple days ago that Thomas Jefferson wrote primarily Thomas Jefferson and other people, Ben Franklin and others, were in the room also, but he primarily, he was the scholar, he was the good writer. And he wrote the Declaration, but then when he brought it to Continental Congress, they edited out some things. And they didn't like this particular thing that was originally written in the Declaration of Independence. This is right after all of those things. Like King George does this, King George is doing this, and this, and this, and this. This is the last thing that's mentioned. I edited out a couple kind of language things, but King George III has waged cruel war against human nature itself, violating its most sacred rights of life and liberty in the persons of a distant people who never offended him, captivating them and carrying them into slavery in another hemisphere, or to incur miserable death in their transportation thither. He is determined to keep an open market where men should be bought and sold He has prostituted his negative for suppressing every legislative attempt to prohibit or to restrain this execrable commerce, and he is now exciting those very people to rise in arms among us and to purchase that liberty of which he has deprived them, and murdering the people upon whom he has also obtruded, forced them. What I find interesting thing about this is that Jefferson recognized that, he was able to recognize that King George was the one responsible for bringing slavery to this country. Possibly. He's blaming King George III for making sure slavery is foisted upon the colonies. But I don't see a lot of recognition here of like, yeah, we kind of agree with him, and this is really benefiting us too. So they took this out. This is not in the final form of the Declaration of Independence because they didn't want to probably deal with the sticky question of, yeah, what are we going to do about this slavery that we really want to keep in place? And after this war is over, I don't know, we still kind of want to have it.
I think that's really interesting because didn't Thomas Jefferson also own slaves?
Oh, yeah. Till his dying day.
Yes.
And he didn't free them on his death. As George Washington did, actually. He decided he wanted to keep him till his dying day, and then he and Martha let him go.
Was there slavery in England before there was
here? Oh, yeah.
Here?
And it
That's
was
what I thought.
The slave trade in England went on the way out before it did in the United States. Mm-hmm. In the U.S., the slave trade itself it was illegal after 1807 to go to Africa and bring them back. But after, of course, slavery continued until 1865. Amendment 13 took place. Okay. I promised that I would bring that up, so I want to kind of move forward. All right. We talked a little bit about race. Assigned membership to a group based on physical characteristics, such as hair, texture, bone structure, or skin color. I'm going to race through a couple of them here, and then I got a question for you. Racism, and this is how I'm going to define it, personal, institutional, and cultural structures that reinforce the idea that people with one set of physical characteristics are superior to people with a different set of physical characteristics. If I might just have you turn to a person to either side of you and just, can you pick out key terms in here? Between these two definitions, which terms stand out to you as important in either of these two definitions? I'll give you about 3 minutes for that. Good to go? Which terms stand out as particularly important in this? Go ahead and go. I know it's... I'm sorry to cut your conversation off. I do respect the words that you have to say and thoughts. But I want to see what you've come up with. What are some key terms in these two definitions? What do you think is important?
Physical characteristics.
Okay. Physical characteristics.
Assigned. Yeah.
Assigned. Assigned by whom?
Yeah,
right.
Superior to.
Superior to. That's key.
Reinforce.
Reinforced by what? And by
whom?
Idea.
Yeah.
By the
idea.
Based on
physical
characteristics.
Yeah, right. Sarah was just showing me a picture of her and four friends. I'm assuming they're friends.
Very much so.
Okay. Four friends who are pictured. It's a sunny day, so some of them have hats on and that kind of thing. I'm going to hold that picture. Actually, it's really important that you just raise that, because I want to bring two other terms here. I'm going to skip over these, except for the one about white privilege. And this is one we're going to get at much today, at the risk of focusing too much on the white situation. And yet, I think it's important for us to understand who we are and what culture we bring, if you want to identify yourself as white, to this conversation. White privilege, advantages that people identified as white in Western countries enjoy. It's passive language, identified as white, identified by whom, or, you know, to use Ta-Nehisi Coates' language, people who believe themselves to be white. Why do they believe themselves to be white? Why is it important for people to believe themselves to be white? What advantages do they gain in identifying themselves as white if they're passable and not, you know, 100% or even 50 or 20 even percent African American or some other racial group?
So Chris is
Please.
Are you going, it seems like, I can't quite put my finger on it, but we're talking about white privilege mostly in the first session and starting it out now. What's the correct term for black, going the other way, black over white? Is that reverse racism?
Okay, thank you. All right, that term has also been brought up, reverse racism. If racism, and I'll just give a simple definition of racism, which is a little bit more, this one's a little longer. But you want to just walk away with a simple definition. Maybe you could say it's prejudice plus power. Prejudice, we can all have prejudice. We can all prejudge a person, who they are, have our own beliefs about them, establish our own policies and practices around people of a different race. We can all do that, no matter what race we come from. Power is the deciding factor, however. Can we have power over people of another race? Can all people go there? And I'm assuming that's what you mean by reverse racism. Let me ask, can an African-American, a black person, have power over a white person?
Yes.
How? I don't know. I don't know the answer. Actually, I kind of got my opinion. But those of you who are saying yes, why?
They can be your boss.
Okay, so they can be your boss. They can have power in that way. They can direct you and tell you what to do. In terms of the definition of racism, personal, institutional, cultural, can they control the beliefs about, can they have a certain belief about you and put you in your place, so to speak, as an African-American person? Do they have that kind of cultural power over you? Do they have institutional power to change the way institutions view you and establish policies that affect your life?
No, I don't think so.
Well, don't they have, they call us names, honky, whatever. They have their...
I think that might be, maybe it's a prejudice, but again, there's no power involved in it, unless you respond to that by allowing them to, kind of hurt your feelings or whatever. There's no power in that.
Well, I think you have to look at the context. If we're talking in the context of the United States, it's very difficult. I lived in Japan and was a physical minority there. Mm-hmm. Generally, that was positive, but not always. Mm-hmm. So my takeaway from that experience is I was just being me, but 24/7 I'd look up and someone was looking at me like, wow, what are you?
Right. And
it depends on where you are.
And even then, in my experience of living in another country also, the Philippines, I never felt like, because of my skin color, I wouldn't receive some privilege, whether it's, respect from people or, if I was looking for a job there, I wasn't, but if I was looking for a job, I could always expect that my skin color would help me rather than hurt me. Even in the Philippines, as a complete minority, obviously. And I don't know if you felt the same way in Japan or those of you who felt who've been to another country where people are of a different skin color, but did you ever get the sense that your skin color would ever get in the way of your receiving some kind of privilege?
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you.
Sorry, I'm so I think the question of the power, an ism, and that could be any sort of ism, the established definition is power plus prejudice, and power really comes about as an institutional system, so we might have a personal interaction, but if it's based on an ism, it comes out of the institutional longer-term system. So a boss might, in that moment, in that employment situation, have some power, but in the broad sense of society, wouldn't, if it's not a white person. So the way I've heard it defined is somebody who's African-American can't be racist, they'd be prejudiced. Or discriminatory or personal interactions that are negative but not racist because of that big power structure that we're seeing.
When I think of your question about power, I think what's behind that, and I come up with two things. One is the ability as a group or a person to make decisions that have consequences that, well, that have consequences. And the other would be having resources. And so the background of yours, when you ask a white society and a black society, does the white society have the ability to make decisions that have consequences and vice versa? And do they have the resources to either withhold or share those things would demonstrate power to me? So my answer is no, the black community does not have that power.
Very insightful. So how are people of color excluded in society? Underserved, financially exploited, oppressed, or invalidated? And how are white people included? And how are they served? How are they financially resourced? How are they uplifted and validated simply because of skin color? And can you imagine, okay, so here's a black employer, and she's looking at a resume, and sees John Johnson on that resume, and says, I don't know about that name. I think I'll just put that resume over there. Here's Jamal. I think I'll look at that one. Can you ever imagine that happening?
Of course it does.
It possibly.
Because at a personal level, not on a cultural level, but on a personal level, we're human.
Yeah. I would say it happened. I don't expect being invited to the Black Panther Party or go to... I remember feeling very uncomfortable going to a B.B. King concert. Mm-hmm. I was the only, our group was the only white people in the whole establishment. And we didn't get served, we got seated next to the restroom doors, I think blacks are capable of being as racist as I am.
Cynthia?
I think it's really important in looking at racism to acknowledge that individuals who are black or Latino or whatever can of course have power and wealth and individual privilege that might be greater than an individual white person. So a homeless woman sleeping under the bridge does not have the power, a white woman does not have the power that a black CEO has. Mm-hmm. So on an individual basis, that is of course true, but on a broad spread societal basis, we're looking at a situation in which as a society and as sectors, the white sector has so much more power than the black sector. And as I understand it, that can be looked at through a couple of lenses, and one is the lens called dominance, which means which people are most present in positions of power and privilege. So in white society, the majority of our congresspeople, our legislators, our bankers, in most communities are white. So that gives the white sector power. And a second way of looking at that is what is the center, what is the norm, and who are the other? And in a white, in U.S. society, the norm is still white. So others are others. And that gives whiteness power. And third, that structures are set up such that it's much easier to get ahead if you're white. Now that doesn't pertain to all individuals, because a young black woman raised in a household of privilege may end up going to Harvard and whatever. But as a whole, it's far easier to get ahead if you're white. For instance, my colleagues of color in the university all go through knowing that someone thinks that they're there because they got a break because they were black. Whereas no one questions that about me, or the dominoes that come, or how much more likely you are to get sent into detention or expelled if you're a middle schooler and you're dark black and you come from a black neighborhood than if you're white and you come from a very white neighborhood. I'm saying it's not a matter of that some individuals can get power. It's a matter of how society is set up to advantage
some and not others.
And that touches upon, definitely, thank you. That definitely touches upon the assumption that I came with. I showed it on one of my slides on Monday. We believe in that we live in a meritocracy, but we behave like we live in one, but we don't actually live in a meritocracy. And this touches upon your comment that there are people who believe, well, I know people of color who are successful. I know black people. I know President Obama. There's an example that racism is over.
Yeah.
But
your example was very specific. I agree 100% with what you're saying. But your example is a personal interaction. So if you would have given an example of, could I believe in our country we would pass a law that in a budgeting system, when a parent group raises money for a school, it doesn't have to leave that school. So even though we have a really wealthy white school in that same district and a very poor, I believe that law could easily be passed, and would be passed. I guess I take issue with the example you gave.
Okay, thank you.
Which I can't even remember.
Was looking at a resume based on the name and putting it in the file.
There have been lots of studies done though about resumes with not having a. Whether you have a photo, in fact, I don't know if you can have photos anymore, but you know, we're taking the names off of identical resumes and, no, I got that wrong. Identical resumes with different sounding names on them that have been proven that people will kind of pass by names that don't sound white, Caucasian, so. And the things like, more black children being kicked out of kindergarten and preschools because of behavior and things like that. But
I'll go over here. Thank you.
Yeah, I also think it's important to remember, if anyone's immersed in an environment where everyone else is a different race, like, that's probably going to be uncomfortable. But for people of color, like, just living in this kind of white-centric social structure, like, that's kind of an ever-present, like, awareness. So I was just going to say, I just think one of the discomfort does not necessarily mean you're being, discriminated against. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's uncomfortable, sure, but does it mean anything about social structure now? And I think one moment of discomfort is, kind of pales in comparison to the daily realities of being a person of color in the United States.
Thank you. Let's go over here.
Listen, I don't know enough to be anything but dangerous, but a speaker was leading this kind of thing, and his question was very simple to the white crowd. Raise your hand if you wish you were black. And no one did. And my guess is if you ask that same question to a group of African Americans, you might get a different response. I know that being white is better for me. That's privilege.
That question illustrates the reason why racism is alive and well. Who in here wishes they were black?
Except for that one lady.
All right. A couple other terms. Nationality. The status of belonging to a particular nation, whether by birth or naturalization. Perhaps you can all identify your nationality. Ethnicity. Assigned membership to a group based on common origin or common culture. Tease out the difference between nationality and ethnicity. And then cultural, shared patterns of behaviors and interactions that are learned by socialization. So what I want to show you is, and then I want to challenge you here. Here's a definition of a person of color. Can someone read that out loud?
Assigned membership to a group based on physical characteristics such as hair texture, bone structure, or skin color.
Great. Excellent. And someone can read the definition of white?
Assigned membership to a group based on physical characteristics such as hair texture, bone structure, or skin color.
What's the difference? And what difference do we make of it?
One is good, one is bad.
I think that's a really
great example of this idea of what's normative, of normativity, because white is a color as much as black or brown or whatever else, but we call persons of color people that are not white, which means white is the norm and the others are the other.
I have an activity at this point, but what I find real rich is the conversation that we're having. What I had thought to do was to have you identify your nationality, maybe on paper. And I've got pencils and paper up here and all that. This is an activity that I have done in the past, and I've kind of thought through, what is my nationality, and what is my culture, and what is my ethnicity? I don't know if any of you have ever done this kind of thing, but getting at who are we coming to this conversation at? How are we coming to this conversation? What is our identity? It's vitally important to moving forth our understanding and being part of the conversation about race. So maybe what I'll do is I'll just have you, oh my goodness, it's probably too small for you to see. Can you see way back there in the mezzanine section?
I can.
Okay.
She's young.
All right. Anybody cannot see this, the words written on here? Okay.
See them or read them?
Okay, there's a difference. Briefly, when we approach this conversation, we look at somebody and immediately we have this, we assign them race. We assign them a category. We assign them a sector, if you will. And we draw differences. And it's we often look at the stuff on the top of the iceberg first. Stuff like, what do they eat? How do they dress? What kind of music do they listen to? What kind of crafts, dance, literature, language, celebrations, games? Skin color obviously would be up there too. Those are things that we often use, those are the tools we often use to decide whether someone is from this belongs to this category or this category. Oftentimes, getting down here is where it requires a little bit more depth relationship conversation. Things like contextual conversation patterns, body language, notions of leadership, patterns of group decision making. I mean, I don't know how many of you decide, well, this person's black because they make decisions this way, and white because they make decisions this way. Maybe. Concept of self, concept of past and future. I'm just raising this, giving you this image just to say we judge very quickly based on very cursory experience with a person, largely on these kinds of things, when there's so much more to a person, obviously. I know that, sorry if that sounds cliche. There's so much more to a person than just what meets the eye. Maybe for the next 10 minutes, what I'll have you do take a piece of paper and a pencil and identify your nationality and identify your culture and identify your ethnicity, at least to start there, so that you understand who you are and who you are bringing yourself to this conversation. I've done this. I've done a kind of a concentric circles model, and I also actually added into here gender and age. What are my concepts of gender and age? But for the purpose of simplicity for this conversation, maybe I'll just have you briefly identify your nationality. What is it? What is your nationality? What is the nation to which you belong? What is your ethnic background? Your cultural practices and that.
Chris, I have a question. On this slide, are you talking about culture rather than race?
Yeah, I want to get at who, I want to help you understand what your identity is as you come to this conversation of race. If nationality and ethnicity are the same thing for you, if you're Norwegian and you're from Norway, do those mean the same thing or are they different things? And does being Norwegian mean that you are hardworking? Does it mean that you're lazy? Does it mean that you're closed off and you don't really have a lot of conversation with people? My patterns of conversation is kind of tight-lipped and that kind of thing. Is that what ethnicity, your ethnicity is? Go back to this. Assigned membership based on common culture and common origin and common culture. So assigned membership to a group based on a common culture. My culture is this, and that's what ethnicity is. Culture is shared patterns of behavior. These two are definitely related. These are the two that are most difficult to tease out. But this one's the easiest. I come from Norway. I come from Lesotho. These two, that one's a little bit more difficult. Maybe without having to haul out the paper. Maybe just talk to people next to you. Looking at the, I'll bring up the concept of culture again, but just identify yourself as much as you're able. In terms of your national origin, or what nation you identify yourself with, and then your ethnic background and culture. I'll put this back up here. Okay? Let's spend a couple moments just kind of center ourselves. Who are you? All right, come on back again. What I wanted to do with this exercise is to help you understand who you are. And, you know, we're growing people, and you know, this is a lifelong process. Some of you are farther along on that road than others of us. But today's workshop, if anything, is about white-centeredness and how culture is white-centered. And we'll see how that operates and plays out in culture. But before I take a break, yes, we're taking one today. Sorry for Monday, we went all the way through the 2 hours and I didn't respect your need to take a drink of water or take care of business. But I'll send you off with this.
Oh my God.
Hi there.
Hi.
Nice day, huh?
Yeah, finally, right?
Where are you from? Your English is perfect.
San Diego. We speak English there.
Where are you from?
Well, I was born in Orange County, but I never actually lived there.
I mean before that.
Before I was born.
Yeah, like, well, where are your people from?
Well, my great-grandma was from Seoul.
Korean. I knew it. I was like, she's either Japanese or Korean. But I was leaning more towards Korean.
Amazing.
I'm Chasina. There's a really good teriyaki barbecue place near my apartment. So I actually really like kimchi.
Cool. What about you? Where are you from?
San Francisco.
But where are you from?
Oh, I'm just American.
Really? You're Native American?
No, just regular American. Oh, well, I guess my grandparents are from England.
Oh, well. I think your people's fish and chips are amazing. Really? I'm weird? Must be a Crane thing.
Okay, so the question I'm going to leave you with as you go off to your break is, what is normal? All right, take care of business, whatever you need. We'll come back in about 5 minutes. All right, well, that is 5 minutes. Let's go ahead and convene again. And so I put onto the screen in front of you something that my guess is many of you are already familiar with, but I bring it to this class because it's so, I think, important and helpful in understanding what whiteness is, what is normal. And in our culture, if you're white, you're kind of like a fish swimming in the ocean. You don't really recognize the water around you because it's just culturally white. But what I'd like to do is identify it and I eventually think and encourage you to move it around and see what it would feel like to decenter that whiteness. So Peggy McIntosh is a well-known name. It's hard to imagine that Peggy McIntosh originally put this together nearly 30 years ago. If you've been to any racism workshops, the name Peggy McIntosh is familiar to you. But I'm bringing it to this one because I think it is so seminal in understanding what whiteness is. And she says that she, She came up with this list when, as she was waking up in the morning, she'd keep a pad next to her bed, and she'd say, oh, yeah, that's also an example of how I am privileged as a white person. Oh, yeah, that's another way that I'm privileged as a white person. So the list that you're about to see is just so many ways in which white people are centered, normalized, if you will, in our culture. It's the standard. It's regular American, is it not? Well, let's see how. All right. I can, if I wish, to be in the company of people of my race most of the time. I can be sure that my biological children will be given curriculum materials that testify to the existence of their race. I can go shopping alone most of the time, pretty well assured that I will not be followed or harassed. I can turn on the television or open to the front page of the paper and see people of my race widely represented. When I'm told about our national heritage or civilization, I'm shown that people of my color largely made it what it is. I can go to a music shop and count on finding the music of my race represented, into a supermarket and find the staple foods which fit with my cultural traditions. I can swear or dress in secondhand clothes or not answer letters without having people attribute these choices to the bad morals, the poverty, or the illiteracy of my race. I can do well in a challenging situation without being called a credit to my race. I am never asked to speak for all the people of my racial group. I can criticize our government and talk about how much I fear its policies and behavior without being seen as a cultural outsider. I can be pretty sure that if I ask to talk to the person in charge, I will be facing a person of my race. I can easily buy posters, postcards, picture books, greeting cards, dolls, toys, and children's magazines featuring people of my race. I can go home from most meetings of organizations I belong to feeling somewhat tied in, rather than isolated, out of place, outnumbered, unheard, held at a distance, or feared. I can take a job with an affirmative action employer without having co-workers on the job suspect that I got it because of my race. I can choose blemish color or bandages in flesh color that have them more or less match my skin. All right. This is my get up and let's kind of talk, if you will. Indulge me. I want to see what you are thinking, but more, I would like you to kind of interact with yourselves rather than just kind of have people call out. So let's form a circle, two. And I want you to think of a couple questions. I think we might have to move the chairs here off to the side and then have one inner circle and one outer. We might be able to do this, but the same number of people on the inside circle as on the outside circle. Can you go ahead and do that now? Form two circles, one inner circle and one outside. Try to pair yourselves up between one person from the outside circle and one from the inside. Standing. You're standing. Sorry. Did not indicate that. You're standing. Pair yourselves up, someone from the inside circle. Pair yourselves up with somebody from the outside circle.
Come on.
How are you?
Wait.
Can we form one single circle or one large oval circle? Circle oval.
We're getting there.
Do we have a pair? Everyone's got a pair.
And have you got yourself a partner?
No. Okay.
Yeah, there need to be the same number inside as outside. So if you don't have a partner, move to the inside circle. Has everybody got a partner? All right, so eyes up here, please. What I'd like you to do,
there's one.
If you've got a partner, hopefully you all have a partner.
Okay. Perfect. Well, not halfway.
I'd like you we're gonna move one of these circles. So you're gonna share thoughts with more than one person. That's the whole purpose of this. As you're talking to one person, you're gonna give a response, and then we're gonna move one of the circles. So you're gonna be speaking to another person after a while. Okay, go with it. We do this in middle school. It works great all the time. Not. Okay, so talk with your partner about this question. Was white privilege ever talked about in your household growing up in the ways that Peggy McIntosh identifies? And do you talk about it in your family now? And if not, can that change? Address that question with the person that you're standing in front of right now, or all three. Go ahead. As you're wrapping up, what I'd like you to do, I want you to move, I want the inner circle to go three people to the right. So inner circle, count one, two, three.
Which way?
That way. Go clockwise, one, two, three. Bring it into my middle school classroom. Okay, would the center circle please rotate three people again? This way, I've got a different question for you. This time, when you see it on the board, then you can begin talking about it. Thank the person that you've been just sharing with. Thank you.
To the village volunteers.
You're awesome. I probably didn't do a very good job of explaining what on earth this invisible knapsack is. Peggy McIntosh unpacks this invisible knapsack, these items that are in the backpack that we carry every day. If you identify yourself as white, that's the backpack that we carry. These things that put us into a position of privilege, the Band-Aids that we buy, the jobs that we get, the economic benefits that we receive on a daily basis, these are the things that are inside our invisible knapsack that we carry with us every day. She's unpacking all that stuff for her. That list that we just talked about were all the ways in which white culture is privileged. We receive white privilege from our by the virtue of our very skin color. So the question is, do you wear this invisible knapsack with all of these things which put you into a position of privilege in this culture? And if so, what items do you benefit from the most of the things that we listed about 10 minutes ago? If you don't have that invisible knapsack, what things hold you back? Okay? Actually, I'd like to do this one more time. Same question. Do you wear an invisible knapsack? And if so, what items in it are most beneficial to you? And if there are any that hold you back, what are those items? Let's go ahead and rotate three people again. This is the last time we'll do this. Just three, inner circle, rotate clockwise, three people. Okay. So I think I wanted to take a sizable time in the midst of this workshop to have you speak to one another. Because ultimately, I think that it's not a workshop that's going to change mindsets. And it's not going to be a policy even that's going to change mindsets. It's personal relationships that's going to change people and their thinking. Listening to another human being, nothing is more important than listening to another person's perspective in terms of moving the conversation, any conversation, forward. I'll just tell a personal story at this moment. My nephew doesn't know that he is part of my pivotal part of my evolving understanding of myself. My nephew is African American. His name is Noah. He was born. When was Noah born? Oh, he's 25 right now.
He's 24. He's born in 1993.
Born in 93. I was just entering seminary at that time, 92, and I finished seminary in 96, and then I couldn't find a job in a parish after that. But then I decided to work on a construction crew. I'd had some carpentry experience, and I decided, well, I've got to pay the bills, feed my family, Susan and me. She was going to school at that time, get a job as a carpenter. On the carpentry crew one day, I live in St. Louis. And St. Louis is a very secularized, segregated city. On my crew one day, we were sitting around eating sandwiches and talking, shooting the breeze as you're working hard in the morning and you want to kind of just joke and pal around with each other during lunch. And one of the guys on the crew was a paramedic, gone out with the EMTs and did rescue work when he wasn't a carpenter. And we were joking around with each other, and he said at one point, well, I was called onto this call up in Northport, north of St. Louis. And if you know anything about St. Louis, it is very segregated. Northern side of St. Louis is largely African American, south side is largely white. And there's other pockets of that ethnic groups also in St. Louis. He said, I was called in a fire in North St. Louis, and I guess I had to go. I didn't feel like going. I didn't know the exact words. I can't really do the verbatim right now, but he said, basically, I didn't really want to go. You know, people were kind of a little uncomfortable with that, but they just went with it. He said, well, we eventually got to the place. It was burning, and there was a family inside, and I just thought to myself, well, just let them burn. I was new on this journey of understanding race and racism, and I didn't know what to say. I was aghast, and I didn't say anything ultimately. I didn't pull him aside later in anything like that. But what I wish I had said in retrospect was, my nephew is African American. You would have let him burn? And so I think it's those personal situations. We can read about people on the news. We can read about all kinds of people on the news who get pulled over or who get shot because of their skin color. But when it happens to us, it's a different story. And it happened to me that day. So Noah doesn't really recognize to this day, I had not told him this story, but Noah does not recognize that he is pivotal in my journey toward anti-racism work. I may tell him someday. I'm not sure of anything. Maybe he would be surprised at this story. I have since come upon different conversations, and I've had training now, and I have vocabulary. But it emphasizes the importance of having the vocabulary and having some training, understanding what these terms white privilege mean, understanding what these terms racism mean. And as Gary's pointed out, if we don't have these conversations, what will be a result? Take some of the stuff from your workshop, just to say, where are we heading if we don't start honestly having these conversations and getting at the root of what institutional, cultural, personal racism is, whether we feel we're responsible for it or not? What are the possible outcomes? If violence begins, how do we stop it? Is it stoppable? Okay. I'll tell the other story tomorrow about a different way that I went. But these workshops are in part about telling the history of racism. And we're going to contemporize it today. What I did a couple days ago, and sorry to those of you who don't like to be read to, I completely get that. I'm not really crazy about being read to either. But given the size of our group, what we did is we started from the beginning and we moved to 1862, looking at the train of events and actions and policies that led up to understanding and institutionalizing race, racism, identifying people who are to be disempowered and another group of people who are to be empowered. That's what this timeline is attempting to show. That process of how we got to where we are right now. So I'm going to pass out each one of you, well, any of you, a sheet of paper. And what I'd like you to do is, for now, just look it over. And I'm going to show it on the front, like I did a couple days ago. And you'll be able to see it as people are reading it. And then we're going to add to our timeline. In fact, would you be willing to pass those out to people? We'll add to our timeline as we're going along here. This is where we stopped a couple days ago. And that's that. That's one right on the end there. The year is 1862. It's right in the middle of the war between the states, Civil War, if you will. If you weren't here on Monday, my apologies. I'm not necessarily going to go through all of the moments, but I do want to point out 1640. The place is Jamestown, Virginia, and England. It's England's first English settlers' first permanent settlement in the Americas. And there was one moment in which three men were arrested. There was a system of indentured servitude. That's how many people first started to come. Irregardless of skin color, there were They were indentured servants from England. They were indentured servants from Africa. They were indentured servants from different places around the world. In 1640, three men decided they didn't want to be indentured servants anymore. They ran away. And they were caught, brought back into the then existing legal system. Two men, identified as light-skinned in the court records, were given a sentence of one extra year of indentured servitude. The third man was identified as a man with darker skin. And he was given lashings and inescapable indentured servitude for the rest of his days. It was the first, historians believe it was the first codified identification in the legal system of a different, for the same offense, different skin colors receiving different punishments. Many people look to 1640 in our country as the beginning of the system of racism, identifying one person of a certain skin color as having less privilege than a person of another skin color. So 1640 is the date I just want to kind of point out. There were many other points along the timeline, but let's continue here from 1862. This is now after the war between the states. Let's bring it into modern relevance.
Slavery was abolished by Congress in 1865, Amendment 13. Many former slaves became sharecroppers. Though sharecropping is voluntary in theory, many became indebted to white landowners so that they could not escape. By 1900, 36% of all white farmers in Mississippi were either tenant farmers or sharecroppers. 85% of all black farmers did not own the land they owned.
Right. 1872. The California School Code states that, quote, every school must be open for admission of all white children, making no provisions for the education of Asian Americans, Mexican Americans, African Americans, and indigenous children.
And one thing I didn't mention as we're engaging in this timeline, think about the personal and the institutional and the cultural beliefs that are being formed throughout this timeline. What aspects of racism are being enforced as the timeline goes on?
Okay. Army veteran of the Indian Wars, Charles Pratt, opens the first federally sanctioned boarding school, the Carlisle Industrial Training School in Pennsylvania. His philosophy is to kill the Indian, save the child, and elevate American Indians to white standards. Students are brought to the school by train and upon arrival are given a haircut and an English name. They are forbidden to speak their native language. Punishment is severe and includes the forced washing of mouths with lye soap. Students are taught that their way of life is savage and inferior, and those who wish to retain their culture are stupid, dirty, and backward. The school's initiate a pattern of abuse, including sexual and physical abuse, continuing throughout the school's history into the 1930s.
This is a long period of time, I see, 1877 to 1955, Common Era. During the period between Reconstruction and World War II, nearly 4,000 African Americans are killed in lynchings across 12 southern states. This is not frontier justice carried out by a few marginalized vigilantes or extremists. Many African Americans who are never accused of any crime are tortured and murdered in front of picnicking spectators, including elected officials and prominent citizens, for bumping into a white person, wearing their military uniforms after World War I, or not using the appropriate title when addressing a white person, among other reasons. People who participate in lynchings act with impunity and are even celebrated. Not a single white person is convicted of murder for lynching a black person in America during this period.
1882, the Chinese Exclusion Act is passed, barring most Chinese immigrants from entering the U.S. This is the first time a nationality is barred expressly by name.
1896, the Supreme Court established the doctrine of separate but equal interest servicing of the black man in New Orleans attempted to sit in a white only a railway car. This decision marks the beginning of the Jim Crow era, a period in American history defined by separation between whites and coloreds that was not all equal.
1897, Texas courts ruled that Mexican Americans are not white. In California, Mexican Americans are classified as Caucasian until 1930, when the Attorney General classifies them as Indians, which leads to their segregation in accordance with the California School Code.
1905, founded under the leadership of W.E.B. Du Bois, the Nigerian movement marks an important turning point in the African American struggle for equality. The group sets an aggressive agenda demanding equal rights and an end to racial discrimination. Quote, we claim for ourselves every single right that belongs to a freeborn American, political, civil, and social. And until we get these rights, we will never cease to protest and assail the errors of America. The battle we wage is not for ourselves alone, but for all true Americans. End quote. Niagara gives rise to the National Association for Advancement of Colored People in 1909, whose legal efforts accumulate in the watershed Supreme Court decision of Brown v. Board.
And this name, W.E.B. Du Bois, is an important one. If you hear it again, it is pronounced Du Bois. He pronounced it Du Bois, even though it has a French-looking name. But he was pivotal in so many ways, one of the most well-known figures in early 20th century America.
Okay. Having appeared in 1866 that any person with one-fourth or more Negro blood should be considered a colored person, the state of Virginia changes the percentage to 1/16, thus the construction of race by the U.S. In 1922, early in the century, many immigrants petitioned the courts to be legally designated white to gain citizenship under the 1790 Naturalization Act. The Supreme Court ruled the Japanese are not legally white because science classifies them as Mongoloid rather than Caucasian. Takao Ozawa versus United States. A year later, in U.S. versus Bangat Singhifindin, the court contradicts itself, claiming that Asian Indians are not legally white, even though science classifies them as Caucasian, because whiteness should be based on a common understanding of the white man.
Wow. 1923, Oregon State Legislature passes a number of restrictive laws. The Alien Land Law prevents first-generation Japanese Americans from owning or leasing land. The Oregon Business Restriction Law allows cities to refuse business licenses to first-generation Japanese Americans.
1929, the U.S. government deports thousands of Mexicans, including U.S. citizens, to Mexico during the Great Depression. A year later, Mexicans are classified separately on the census to limit their immigration and reinforce their distinctness from white.
Thank you. 1942. President Roosevelt signs an executive order requiring all Japanese Americans and resident Japanese aliens living in military areas on the West Coast to relocate to internment camps scattered throughout the country. Nearly 120,000 people, two-thirds of whom are U.S. citizens, are incarcerated. Their homes and property are seized and sold to white Americans at reduced cost. This is my stepdad.
The weird thing about this is the Japanese in Hawaii were not molested by this at all.
Only on the continental U.S.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. 1948.
47, the GI Bill subsidizes employment, suburban home loans, and college education opportunities for veterans returning from World War II, but refuses to challenge the discriminatory practices embedded in the practices and policies of employers, bank lenders, and college institutions. As a result, almost all of the benefits of the bill go to white veterans and their families.
An interesting example of a policy that, on the face of it, does not privilege white people, but in its practice, definitely did.
1950, when Nazism takes the idea of racial inferiority to a horrifying extreme, is race science finally discredited. After the Holocaust, the United Nations issues an official statement declaring that race has no scientific basis and calling for an end to racial thinking in scientific and political thought. Its principal author is Ashley Montague, a student of Franz Boas. Although important, this shift in scientific thinking has little impact on social policy or the ingrained public attitudes about race.
In 1954, the Supreme Court rules in Brown versus the Board of Education that separate means unequal and mandates the segregation of public schools. Thus, Jim Crow America begins to crumble. In Southern schools, however, thousands of black teachers and principals are fired as school boards claim that white parents will not allow their children to be taught by black teachers. As a result, thousands of white men and women get jobs in the newly integrated schools, while black teachers and administrators, often the backbone of the African American community, are shut out of the education system.
We live that legacy today.
In 1980, building on President Nixon's war on drugs, the Reagan-Bush-Clinton administrations expand this war, increasing the number of people behind bars for nonviolent drug offenses from 50,000 in 1980 to over 400,000 by 1997. In the late 1980s, Congress passed draconian penalties that rapidly increased the prison population. The U.S. currently spends more than $51 billion on the war on drugs, and we incarcerate one in every 99 adults, the highest incarceration rate in the world. Over two-thirds of those in prison are black or Latino, although these populations use and sell drugs at the same rate as whites. And I want to add something to this. The union for the guards in the prisons campaigned for this because it meant more jobs.
Campaign for mass incarceration?
Yep.
Interesting. When you hear language, it's interesting. Certain phrases and words are code language for, if you will, racism. When you hear tough on crime, lots of presidents love to say, let's get tough on crime. Well, what's the effect of that? That is code language for let's lock them up. Whether they mean to or not, and I'm not going to judge a president or a politician whether they intend that or not, but the effect is lock them up or tough on crime. The effect of that is mass incarceration, which primarily targets people of color.
The 1980s. The U.S. launches the biggest prison building spree in the history of the world. The fastest growing group of prisoners are black women. Native Americans are the largest group per capita. Approximately 5 million people, including those on probation and parole, are directly under the surveillance of the criminal justice system. Prisons have also become profit centers. More and more prisons are being privatized, with the two largest private prison companies showing growing profits every year. In addition, many corporations use cheap prison labor to enhance their profits. These have included IBM, Motorola, Compaq, Texas Instruments, Honeywell, Microsoft, Boeing, Revlon, and Pierre Cardin. Schools throughout the world buy graduation caps and gowns made by South Carolina prisoners.
September 11th sets the stage for a national security-based immigration policy. The Patriot Act gives the government broad powers to detain suspected terrorists for unlimited periods of time without legal representation. Over 1,200 Arab, Muslim, and South Asian men are detained in secret.
As a result of the subprime mortgage lending crisis, the total loss of wealth for people of color was between $164 and $213 billion over 8 years, perhaps the greatest loss of wealth for people of color in modern U.S. history.
Arizona passes anti-immigration law requiring all aliens over age 14 to register with the U.S. government after 30 days and to carry ID documents at all times. State law enforcement are thus required to determine immigration status whenever an officer has a reasonable suspicion that a person is an illegal immigrant. Penalties are imposed on those who hire and transport unregistered aliens. All but 7 states have passed anti-immigration laws, including many copycat laws based on Arizona's.
2012, Trayvon Martin, a 17-year-old African-American from Miami Gardens, Florida, is fatally shot by George Zimmerman, a neighborhood watch volunteer. A jury acquits Zimmerman of second-degree murder and of manslaughter in July 2013. After the death of Martin, the media focus on the case develops a national debate about racial profiling and self-defense laws. Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, and Eric Garner share a similar story.
You can name many, many more, I'm absolutely certain.
2013, the Supreme Court strikes down the provision of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that required certain states and local governments to obtain federal approval before implementing any changes to their voting laws or practices. This provision existed to address entrenched racial discrimination in voting. Since the ruling, several states have passed laws that restrict or eliminate online voting registration, early voting, same-day registration, and pre-registration for teens about to turn 18. The ruling has also resulted in several states implementing stringent voter identification laws and eliminating hundreds of polling places, undermining the right to vote for hundreds of thousands of U.S. citizens.
In December 2015, USA Today reported that Donald Trump is the second most admired man in the U.S. behind President Obama. Among Trump's campaign pledges, deport thousands of illegal and undocumented immigrants, ban Muslim immigration to the U.S., reinstitute stop and frisk, a policy proven to be rooted in racial discrimination. His message of disdain for all those who do not fit the traditional definition of an American citizen has found resonance with huge numbers of people and is resulting in cultural permission for explicit racist and hate speech directed towards immigrants and people and communities of color.
2016. After being offered a job as a customer service representative at a company in Alabama, Chastity Jones is asked to cut her dreadlocks in order to comply with the company's grooming policy. The company requires employees to be dressed and groomed in a manner that projects a professional and businesslike image. After Jones refuses to change her hair, the job offer is rescinded and and the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission files a lawsuit on her behalf. In a 3-0 ruling, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals dismisses the lawsuit, citing that hair, unlike skin color, is not an immutable characteristic.
2017,
2017 at the Alzheimer's Association International Conference in London in July, researchers reported that harsh life experiences, poverty, disadvantage, and stressful life events appear to leave African Americans particularly vulnerable to Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia.
This was just a few days ago. I just wanted to bring all the slides to, like, now. And this little, if you go to the Alzheimer's International Conference website, it says there's a picture that says, older African Americans are about 2 times as likely to have Alzheimer's and other dementia as older whites. You know, and I bring this is my last slide, because I just want to bring it into context. If you got anything from this timeline, many people think, well, slavery's over. Racism may still be alive, but at least we don't have slavery anymore. Well, do we? Because we're just changing the slides, if you will. Racism was alive and well as we created it in 1640, through slavery, through chattel slavery, if you will, the buying and selling of human beings. That is obvious. Slavery was ended, of course, in 1865 and then in 13, but then you've got debt peonage, and people hired on through the system of sharecropping, who could not escape their debt as hard as they worked, because, oh, their debt just gets higher and higher, and they'll never escape that kind of work. Then in the late 1800s, of course, through Plessy versus Ferguson, you've got the creation of a separate but equal, which was anything but equal. Certainly separate, but certainly not, definitely separate, but certainly not equal. And then the Jim Crow laws, of course, solidified that and institutionalized Plessy versus Ferguson. And now, of course, since the latest civil rights movement began in the 1950s, Jim Crow fell away, and then we had to think of a different way to move forward this racism. And that way was found through mass incarceration. It has been the latest way that people of color have been put in their place. When and if that ends, and my guess is that it will end at some point, racism as an institution will continue. It will find another way, unless we choose to put our foot down, unless we as people of faith choose to change the way we think, it will continue. It will continue, guaranteed. All right, on that happy note, we're going to finish today. Friday's session actually will be more, how can we move this conversation forward as we move down the mountain and move into the rest of the world? What language can we use? What mindset can we use to engage the world? Obviously, Kirsten's sessions have been very helpful in ways of finding ways through bullying. Much of that can be applied through this conversation also. So the timeline's done. It's going to stay up on the wall. Look at it. It'll stay up until Saturday. But thank you for coming, and I look forward to our conversation on Friday.